Welcome to the Impact Conversations, a Nijrode podcast. I am Brechtje Spijkerman.
And I am Janan Amelink. In this podcast series, we discover the stories behind the researchers and their work.
We believe that education and research at Nijrode serves a purpose in society, shaping responsible leaders.
We like to share what impact Nijrode research has made on society. Let's go.
Hey, Jan-Anne.
Hey, hoi.
Ah, we're back on track with this impact conversation on sustainability.
I know. It's about institutional change, right?
That sounds wonderful already.
And we have two wonderful guests, so tell me, who's the first guest?
The first guest, her name is Tineke Lamboy, and she's professor of corporate law at Nijrode Business University. I've never had her for class. Okay. Well, she conducts multidisciplinary research project aimed at the implementation of sustainability goals by private companies.
That's really impressive.
I know.
Sounds complicated, but we'll see what she does. Also with us, we have Dr. Nicolas Chevrolet. He's an associated professor, especially around stewardship and sustainability. And he actually, a little fun fact, which we'll probably talk about a little bit, but he was my supervisor for my thesis project. So he's a wonderful guy. I really, really like him. I look forward to chatting with him and Tineke, of course.
Wow. So I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Let's go.
Tineke and Nicolas, welcome to the Impact Conversation. Jan-Anne, good to see you again.
Good to see you again. It's been a while.
We're talking about institutional change.
Correct.
And impact.
And the impact.
I think, Nicolas, you shared a wonderful story about your son, what he said, if you don't mind sharing, as a way to talk about impact, because he is a professional soccer player.
He wanted to.
And so what did he then turn up to you and what did he say?
He said he doesn't want to be a professional football player anymore because he thinks that football players do not bring impact to the world. So he wants to do something else. He wants to have change in the world. So that's what he told me a few months ago. And now he's doing something else.
What is he doing now?
Well, he's trying actually to find a profession where indeed he can put this trigger that will change actually things around him.
That's
so
beautiful.
He's still very young. He still has a lot to do. But
do you think he's an exception? Because
no, I think his generation is much more aware mm-hmm. of the problematics, ecological or social, around him. Mm-hmm. So they are willing to do much more. But of course, it's only a little piece of the puzzles when it comes to change in institutions, in society. So he's a citizen. He will do something. But to change actually a full society, you need much more. Mm. You need much more angle. So perhaps, Tineke, you can tell us a bit more about those different angles of change that we can see in the society.
Yeah, thank you. I think the first game changer is the mind. If you really want sustainability, you will go for it. So I think it's not a little factor in the whole spectrum. I think it's the most important factor in the whole spectrum, that people want something else. So I think what your son is showing, that is really important for developing a new look at the world and to change the world towards a more sustainable society. And coming back to your question, institutional change, what would that be? How we look at it as academics? Within Nijrode, we often use the framework of Lawrence Lessig. He's a new Chicago School scholar. And how he explained his theory is that there are four drivers towards people's behavior. One is legislation, rules, so you have to change your behavior. The second one is the market. So the market, the economic factors in life that mm-hmm. can also change your behavior. When, mm-hmm. you know, there's the potatoes are cheaper here, yeah. you almost are pushed to buy them here rather than the more expensive ones there.
Well, I even see it within myself now. I now am more likely to buy like a vegetarian burger because they're a little cheaper and they're right. also much better than they were 5 years ago when I first tried them.
Yeah,
and so then, provides another incentive, I guess.
Yeah, and then the third driver is social and cultural norms. So if everyone around you does this, like becoming vegetarian,
right.
you feel the outside person if you don't join them. So you want to be part of the group. So that's a very powerful driver. And then the fourth one is architecture. And architecture, you can explain by thinking of the physical and technical world around you. So to make this example more clear, we wanted people to stop smoking because it's bad for your health. It's bad for other people's health when you smoke. So we started to change people's behavior by implementing legislation. You cannot smoke in the train or in the plane or everywhere in public buildings. Then we started to use the economic driver by putting more taxes on each package of cigarettes. And then we also tried to change the cultural and social norms by having all those posters and also pictures on the packages of cigarettes with horrible medical consequences of smoking. Mm-hmm. And then we also changed the technical compilation of a cigarette, so with less tar, less nicotine in it. Mm-hmm. So that's then the fourth driver. And you can ask yourself, then there's also in the field of sustainability, self-regulation. So you will maybe explain that a little bit more about CO2 emissions or so and the metrics, how to calculate that. And there you can ask yourself, is that then part of legislation, so of the rules, or is it part of market forces because it's the market that asks for it? Or is it part of the social and cultural norms because it reflects a change in the norms? So yeah, you can put that between legislation and social and cultural norms and economic norms.
And what I like about what Tineke has mentioned is that you have those different forces, but what you hear out there is that most of the time people tell you, well, if you want to change, the government would pull a rule and everything is going to change. So the regulation part, when you think of institutional change, that's what people have in mind. Mm. The government will come, will put the rules, everything will change. But what is very important, what Tineke has mentioned, is that that's only one piece of the puzzle.
Mm, right.
And if you wait in the framework that we are investigating that are also in the case, if you look at the phases of market transformation, the rules that the government put in place come at the later stage. Mm. Most of the time, actually, many other things come before. Change of perspective, social norms are changing, technological development, all those type of things come first. And then eventually comes the regulation. So there is an appetite for people to say, oh, somebody else will solve it for us and this change will come. But most of the time there are many, many things that needs to happen before. And I think that's the beauty of looking at market transformation or social change from this lens. It gives you a lot of different perspectives to analyze it.
And I think it also shows that business are drivers for that change instead of just institutional change.
Exactly. They are part of the drivers. You know, they are like many other stakeholders, a reason why this is changing. Right? So they do piloting of technology, they compete on different sustainability proposition. You mentioned actually the vegetarian burger. While you would have come 6 years ago, they will all be fighting at Albert Einstein with all their brands of burgers and let the best and the strongest survive. Well, one now, only a few have survived. They are much better, much cheaper, economy of scale. And now the regulation can come. You know, the market is ready for the market to come. And that's how institutions change come with phases along the way.
Yeah.
With change with many stakeholders.
Yeah, I fully agree. And my PhD was about corporate social responsibility. I started in 2004, ended that in 2010. And what I was researching were the laws that were changing behavior of people. So about due diligence, so CSR due diligence, about non-financial reporting, about avoiding corruption programs, about corporate governance, about investing in biodiversity and having biodiversity as a topic to collect information about to share with your investors. And what I also looked at many best practices, and what I saw that it's that it's influencing each other. On the one hand, you have the best practices of companies that want to move forward, and also social enterprises, don't forget them, the pilots in our society. And then on the other hand, you have rules, self-regulation, formal regulation. So it influences each other. Mm. So sometimes the rules influence behavior, sometimes the best practices influence the rules, because the best practices show what is possible technically for companies to do, and also what is acceptable in society.
Tineke, you started in 2004?
With the PhD research.
Probably wasn't that popular of a topic.
No, corporate social responsibility wasn't a term that people really understood. So I started my PhD by making a book with interviews. Interviews with people in different disciplines. So people who work in politics, in governments, in NGOs, academics, companies, even in theology. So a bishop was one of the interviewees. So to ask them, what is your perspective on the topic of corporate social responsibility, and who can take which role? So that's actually the beginning of my PhD. I published a book in 2006 with interviews. So it was exploring the field.
Yeah.
But myself, I was already working on it since 2000, no, before 2000, so 1997 or so. I started with researching this topic because it really interested me what the role of companies can be in this perspective.
And so I assume you've really seen a change happening in terms of, you also mentioned ESG reporting. Like, I assume that there's a massive difference from 2000 till now. What are some key differences or, like, I guess, developments you've seen?
Yeah. Thank you for the question.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah. So in 2000, a lot of soft law norms were adopted and published, and self-regulation was developed and published. So I'm thinking about the Global Compact of the United Nations. I'm thinking that soft law, the OECD guidelines for multinational companies, soft law. I'm thinking about GRI, Global Reporting Initiative, which is more self-regulation. So it's a multi-stakeholder initiative about non-financial reporting.
And a soft law, is that, how is that different? How should I interpret soft law?
Okay, from an international law perspective, soft law means all the decisions and resolutions of international organizations that are not formal law, so that are not a treaty.
Okay.
So like a resolution of the UN would be
soft law.
Qualified as soft law. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And non-financial reporting, well, the word says it all, but you use it like it's a common term.
Yeah.
Terminology.
Well, going back to the question, what did you see as a change in the last 20 years? Yeah, so what I first saw is around the year 2000, there was a very important moment when all those new norms and ideas came out. The Earth Charter, that's a people's document about what are the norms that everybody should live to, should behave. No, that's not the right way of explaining. Well, so then you saw a whole bunch of norms coming out. Then in the first 10 years, many companies were responding to that, like, I don't know what it is. I'm only a business person. I'm not involved in politics. So when we talk about human rights, like the human rights in Syria, all those companies who were selling oil there to the government, they said, we're not in politics. This is
business.
This is business, right? And then in the year 2011, new norms came up that made it more clear that due diligence obligations, so looking within your own operations and activities, but also in your supply chain, if there are any human rights violations, that those norms came up. So that made it more clear that it applied to all companies in the world. So those were the UN norms, the UN guiding principles developed by Professor Ruggie of Harvard Business University and his team. Also new OECD norms came up, including this due diligence obligation for all companies, but then it's for the companies in the OECD member states. And still, companies were then saying, yes, we are endorsing all those new norms, also the Millennium Development Goals, Sustainable Development Goals. Mm-hmm. But the real change I've only seen the last 5 years that companies are...
Really
but it's
engaging.
Also because, but it's also because there are younger people that are voicing within those companies. So those young people's networks were there also in 2005. But now they are more empowered. They are at higher positions and
that's
can implement things.
It starts like this, but I must say I've got the same feeling as Tineke. You know, when you think of CO2, you have this Paris Agreement in 2015. That was the start of something. And then you could see that it was a norm. It was a soft law, Paris Agreement. Okay,
maybe.
We have a Paris Agreement. We have to reduce CO2. And so what?
Yeah.
And it really started to flame in the companies where they realize, okay, we can do something on sustainability. And perhaps it's good business. We can do something about it as well.
But I must say, lots of people are a little bit skeptical when you read about all the sustainability goals and that's a window dressing for what a company does.
Yeah, let me go into that because that was the first topic that's really interesting to look at. So non-financial reporting is an interesting topic. Circular economy is an interesting topic, and also due diligence in your supply chain. So maybe we can discuss all three topics. And the first topics, that is where I saw institutional change, where really the laws changed. The economic drivers pushed that companies are publishing non-financial information. Investors pushed, so that's the market side. The mentality changed. So I know many people in companies that are working on preparing ESG reports, so environmental, social, governance, sustainability reports, and are really collecting in a very dutiful way all that data, all those data that are needed to make a sustainability report, to analyze it, to prioritize issues, to show which are the material issues for this company to contribute in a positive way to sustainability and to avoid negative aspects. And now it's even a level higher. The EU has published a lot of legislation that is mandatory for all companies in Europe. And also for all investors. So it really makes a change. I can really see the institutional change there. Mm-hmm. So that avoids the greenwashing that you were referring to. It aims to avoid the greenwashing.
And you refer also, because recently I read in the newspaper, and I'm an outsider of this topic that you are so passionate about, both of you, that the EU made a huge step making businesses responsible in the chain of trading with other parties. Is that so? That was recently that came up about 2 or 3 weeks ago. How do you see that?
So what you're talking about is the due diligence obligation that companies have, companies that are based in the EU, for their supply chain, and the question whether there are any human rights being violated in that supply chain by supply chain partners. So it could be supply chain partners or downstream from your company to other contracting parties that you work with. So we're actually talking about value chain. Those norms were already there in 2000 in the first soft law instruments and self-regulatory instruments. Then they were put in more clear terms in 2011 in the UN Guiding Principles and the OECD Guidelines. And now the European Union, but also the Netherlands, and also France and England and a few other countries are including it in the mandatory legislation for companies. So what the mandatory legislation entails is that it's more a process norm that the companies perform due diligence, so perform an assessment to find out whether there are any problems in their supply chains or in their downstream chains, and that they try to solve those either by looking for other partners or by addressing those issues really in the partners that they're doing business with.
It also,
but this law actually, it's an interesting one because this law in France is called loi de vigilance. It means that you have it's mandatory for you to look in your value chain and to check what your partners are doing. It's a very good exercise in large companies to raise awareness also of those issues in large companies. The one issue with those laws is that there is no binding effect to those things. If you actually have a huge problem and you don't do anything about it, it's very difficult right now to...
You won't get a fine.
Is it comply or explain? The law of vigilance?
Not completely, actually. So what you see right now, and I see that it's a role for another stakeholder, and it happens actually in the Netherlands not too long ago, you see that some NGOs play the role of actually safeguarding those plea or those assessment from companies.
Right.
One that was used in the news not too long ago was the Dutch government was put actually on trial for not reducing enough its CO2 emission. Shell was put in the news also on the same, with the same type of NGOs actually, Rwanda, trying to tell them, okay, listen, you've made some commitment, you've done some assessment, there is those issues, what are you doing about it? So sometimes actually they keep those companies on their toes, which limits a bit this effect also of greenwashing.
But I was thinking, Nicolas, also, you're in this field of research, but it's very difficult to get your honest data from companies, I guess. How do you...
It depends on there is differences between things. CO2, that's something you measure. It's not something physical. So in there, you start also to have external bodies, like CDP, that try actually to assess, to tag, to validate what the companies are reporting. And so in the field of CO2 now, you have a couple actually of large organizations that say, okay, what you report as a company, is it okay or not?
So they do assurance. They do assessment and assurance on the basis of self-regulation. And I think you also wanted to say something about that.
I mean, I don't have a particular thing to share about it, but of course we've been working on this. I don't think this has been mentioned yet, but Nicolas was my supervisor for my thesis. But do you see actually changes within how companies self-regulate?
Well, it depends how far goes the change. I see change in how they reduce themselves emission. You know, the scope one is what the company need to reduce themselves. What I would like to see much more, and that's a very difficult bite for the company, is they need to reduce also, and we go back to value chain, what's emitted actually in value chain, upstream and downstream. So from customer and from supplier. So let me give you a concrete example there, how difficult that is. Shell was put in the news because they don't reduce enough their scope 3 emission, which is what's going on in the value chain.
Right.
Shell sells oil that you put in your car. So you here around the table as customer, you need to find a way to reduce what you emit by using your car and the produce of Shell.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult for Shell to influence, right? That's how institutional change needs to come. Mm. Not only by what you do as a company, but being self-conscious that you have a role also upstream and downstream in the value chain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, that's key. If the company managed to do so, there will be really drastic change. If they limit themselves to themselves, the change will be somehow limited.
Yeah, and where this comes from is that within the UN and other organizations, it has been acknowledged that companies have such power in the market, economic power, political power.
Political power, yes.
With lobbying and et cetera. Marketing power, production power. So if they design it this way, the product will be this way. If they design it in that way, the product will be designed in a very different way. We can talk about that a little later about circular economy. But so the idea of the institutions in our society are that companies have a big role to play. Also look at the World Business Council for sustainable development, where Peter Bakker is the chair. They also try to move the 250 multinationals that are a member thereof to be that change.
In this next part of the podcast, Jan-Anne is out and about doing interviews on location. Let's go now to a special segment where we dive deeper into the work of the researchers.
welcome, Erwin Milders. For the last 5 years, you've been the program manager of sustainability at the Ministry of Infrastructure and Waterstaat.
Waters?
Waters. And in Dutch, you've branded it as Duurzame EMW. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you.
So what are you guys doing at the ministry around sustainability?
Well, a couple of years back, we've started to take sustainability really seriously. After the Paris Agreement, we've, together with other ministries, made a pledge to make all the ministries work climate neutral. And the next step was, of course, what will the ministry do itself? And then we started a program to well, to take a more professional method of dealing with sustainability at the ministry. So that's what I've been trying to implement over the last couple of years. And I've recently, the program has now ended, and it is now a part of the normal processes of the ministry.
And what's the biggest impact that you guys have made over the years?
I think the biggest impact that we made is to implement a complete plan, do, check, act cycle, which is a part of the CO2 prestatie ladder, the CO2 performance ladder. I think it's even used in other countries now.
And you guys created that system.
It is a system that was created in the Netherlands, actually, by, I think, ProRail was the initiator of the prestatie ladder. And now it is being used by many companies. And it was a way of measuring their CO2 performance in all their operations of the companies. And so the ministry also adopted the CO2 performance ladder. And we're now at the highest stage. When I started, we were at the third stage. That's where most companies start. And when you take a next step on the ladder, you're taking it more seriously and adopting a more professional approach. And then there are more criteria that you have to meet.
So it's kind of a step up in your transformation as a...
Yes.
As a group or as a ministry.
Yeah. So what I was saying, the plan, do, check, act cycle is part of this ladder, but it's also a way of looking at the operations of the ministry. We also make a planning, and then we have to take actions and evaluate it again. I think that part is more difficult for many companies. Are we actually doing well, and how can we improve upon our actions? So this is a system that we introduced, and the first step is, of course, you have to have ambitions. So we set a couple of ambitions for both our projects. So this is the infrastructure projects in the Netherlands. This indirect emissions, so it's not the emissions that we create ourselves, but it's by buying procuring that we have impact on the climate. And we also address our own performance within the ministry itself. So that's a bedrijfsvoering is what we call it. I don't know what the name for that is.
I actually don't know either. But that makes sense. And how does Nairode come into the picture there?
Well, actually, the first step that we took is look at the small picture. So the small picture was already quite big. When we started to address that, it turns out that according to the CO2 performance ladder, for example, also all the ships from the government are part of our footprint. So that's 100 ships, and some of them are going on seas. And we wanted to try to get them climate neutral in 10 years, so by 2030. So that's quite fast. We took quite a while to address this issue. And as soon as we had a strategy for this issue, we turned to the projects. And when we turned to the projects, it got a little bit more difficult because it's a very long cycle where we have discussions with municipalities, political discussions first, of what are we going to do? Are we going to build another road around the city, or do we need new dikes? It's a very complex procedure from the start when we have an initiation of a new project to the actual implementation takes around 10 years. So if you want to make this sustainable, you have to address a lot of different parts of the ministry. And then it turns out to be a little bit more difficult. So there was this large-scale project within the ministry to address more difficult subjects with people from university that you could get some help for your project. So we knew that we wanted to have these projects climate neutral and dealt with in a circular way. But we didn't know exactly how to do this and where to start. So we needed to make it more operational. And then we got in touch with Nijenrode and New Foresight. And at the beginning, I thought, well, this is going to be very complex. And why do we need all this theory? But then it turned out that the theory was actually quite practicable. And that made it really helpful for us, because we are a ministry that we make things in actual practice. It's a building ministry, a physical ministry. So we want to do things. And this was a practical business-like approach, which helped us actually to make the next step to identify.
To really take action.
Yeah, to take action and to identify which are the players that you need and what do these players need to do in what part of the process. So it made us think a little bit, take a step back. But at the same time, it also gave a lot of practical tools.
That's really good. And what is the, when you look at the future, because you guys have goals also for 2030, what more is needed to actually get to the goals that the government has set?
Well, what is needed is we have these funds. We've got two big funds. It's the mobility fund. It's used to be the infrastructure fund. And we have a fund for the Delta works. So that's for all the dikes and so on. And these funds were also always spent in the old fashioned way. Like you have to, it has to be very efficient and responsible. And that's still the case, of course. But now we have a third item that you need to deal with. It's sustainability.
Yeah.
So you also need to spend all your money sustainably. And this is, I think it's around 6 billion a year that we spend. Wow. There's quite a large sum of money. And if you want to do that in a different way, what does it actually mean? Does it mean that we will get a delay in all those projects? And how do you actually do it sustainably? So yeah. It's a transition where you need to look at the whole process and all the steps that need to be taken. It's about technology, it's about the players, it's about rules and regulations.
Yeah, it's
also
not just
European rules.
It's not just one add-on, but it's the rethinking of the whole, all the elements within the system.
Yeah, so that means actually that maybe you can do less projects. And if that is the case, well, that's a political thing too. So we need to discuss this with the minister, even though he or she could think that this is the right way to go. They will want to know it if we get a delay in the number of projects that we actually wanted to get done.
That makes sense. Is there any questions that I forgot to ask you? Or anything that you would really love to share?
Well, maybe it's more of a call. I think it's a call to action, because what we see is that many companies and so on, they have good ambitions, but the real action is where what is needed now. And to show that it actually does work and that we are able to get this transition done. And then we need to have a very good cooperation, I think, between academia and practitioners and government in order to make sure that this whole transition speeds up. Maybe that's my call to action.
Yeah. So call to action and to work together. I think that's a wonderful moment to end on. Thank you so much for being here.
Not at all. Thank you.
So far for our interview on location. Thanks for having us. And now we'll continue with our main interview, back to the table and back to the impact conversation.
I feel like that's also something that's quite tough though with circular economy to like, there's a fair bit, I feel like, of intention, but not enough of like actually getting going. I think it was the chief strategist of Triodos Bank who wrote in the Financial Dagblad recently is like, there's not really, there's an intention there, but not actually a practice. Do you guys see that as well? And do you guys, being the people on this topic, like how are, would that change look like?
Let's acknowledge something, and that's going back to what Tineke introduced initially. Having the intention is the first thing. So it's not bad. It's a good start.
The intention's there.
It's a good start. Yeah. But of course, there is many other things that need to be put in place for this to happen. And I agree with Tineke, the development on circular economy are now a little bit tittering. It's not going very fast. Right? But I think it's okay. And that's why I'm, in a way, I'm a bit contradictory, and I see Tineke doing this with her. So
it's I see Tineke going, no, but let me explain why. We'll get back to that.
When you do institutional change, you need many things to happen. You know, you need different stakeholders to come. You need different technology to come. You need different company to start to compete and develop competitive advantage. When they do so, initially, this, and that's one of the framework we've developed at NAIRO, though, the sustainability performances are not very high when you do so, because you have so many things to do. The sustainability performances becomes higher when company come together and say, okay, this is an issue. Why don't we try to do on some piece of the puzzle together? Mm. You know, we develop synergy together. We develop pre-competitive advantage together. This, we don't see it in the circular economy right now. Mm. So I'm saying it's okay, not that I wish that the change stays like this. No, I wish much more changes. But it's okay in a sense that they're not ready yet to bring those synergy together.
So to start collaborating in terms of...
To start collaborating much more on this topic.
You have to collaborate with a competitor, maybe, or within the chain.
Competitor, it's one thing. Look at some company influence actually others, not by being very, very, very big, but having what I call this mosquito strategy.
I need an example.
Have you ever tried to sleep with a mosquito in a room?
Yes, multiple times.
Is it easy?
No, it's not easy.
Exactly. So some of those
for
companies...
For mosquito it is.
For the mosquito it is, but not for the others. So what company like Dopers, Tony, Fairphone are doing, they're actually trying to bite, you know, with the ass of the elephant. What they are trying to say, okay, we are going to develop such a good proposition that it will inspire others to change as well.
Yeah.
And that's the mosquito strategy I'm talking about. So they don't have to be super big to create institutional change. They have to have a proposition which is appealing, competitive, inspirational. Think of good chocolate, great Fairphone, and these type of things.
And what I like about Tony's as well is that, for example, they now have their label, and so they actually have an open supply chain, so anyone can copy actually what they're doing.
But and don't think they are perfect. It's not a perfect company. Yeah, they are often in the news also because they have issues in their supply chain. But they are inspirational enough to make the other change. You know, you have now, even at Lidl, you have a chocolate called Way to Go. It's inspired from Tony Chocolini chocolate. So it's a way to tell the other big guys, and that's what Tineke was saying, some markets
change.
Are cornered by
the pilots.
The pilots saying, oh, I'm doing something good.
Pilot companies.
Yes.
Yeah.
But social entrepreneurship, what Tineke also knows very well, they change the market not by being big, but having this mosquito strategy. And I think it's perfect strategy.
And giving
actually.
The consumer an alternative.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
But talking about circular economy, so I don't think the institutional change is there. And Nicolas said that's not a problem. So that's when...
that's where it is.
I responded like, it is a problem because it needs to happen fast because biodiversity is in a deplorable state. So when talking about circular economy, you have to start with the design of products. Products, actually, and services. I'm also talking about developing technology and developing software. So you have to start with the design, to really think of the design. How can this product be reused? How can it be deconstructed and the parts be reused? Mm-hmm. First of all, reuse the product. If that's possible, that's on the highest level of circular economy.
Refurbishing?
That's upscaling. That could mm-hmm. also be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So reuse is the first, or refurbish, you can say. Second is that you can recycle the materials so that you can, yeah, tear it apart and use the different parts. Third of is that you put it through the shredder and that you use the elements of the materials. And fourth is, yeah, that you burn it and maybe make electricity of it. So the design of a product is very important. That's the first part.
Mm. Martineke, I'm a little bit disappointed that I thought that circular economy that was booming, and now you're telling me that we're not there at all yet.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are four elements actually that are important for a circular economy. So first is the design. So many companies, and also European Union, Dutch government, they all say that circular economy is so important, circular business model is important. Many companies say that they're developing that. But when you really look at it, it's about the design. Then it's about the production process, so that everything that you use comes from a renewable source. So you use reused raw materials. So you don't use new cotton for making clothes, but you use recycled cottons or other types of fibers that are recycled. The same with for Fairphone, other types, reused metals, recycled metals. And metals can be recycled forever. So it's a very good thing to use and to recycle.
Right,
yeah, metals are a perfect component of products. And then transparency about your supply chain. So you have to make your consumers, as you indicated, Brechtje, know that this is a different product, that this has been made in a circular economy process, circular business process. So transparency about where everything comes from and how it has been processed. So even the chemicals, for instance, in the textile production process can be reused as long as you collect them. And then the last part is to collect your products back. So when a big multinational like we have in the Netherlands and the UK puts a lot of shampoo bottles everywhere in the supermarkets, it would be good if they collect those bottles and recycle them and reuse them, because it's difficult to have different types of plastic brought together and recycle them. So you better have one type at a time and then process that for new materials. And actually, it would even be better if that multinational only sold the powder that you can take home and put some water in, and then you have shampoo instead of selling bottles with water and a little bit of soap in it.
Yes. Package-free world.
But Dineke, may I ask you a question there? Because you have all the solutions for the circular economy. I love it. But there is one that you didn't mention. Because one solution could be, and that's one of my favorite topics now at NAYORDA, is why do you need the product in the first place?
Yeah.
We're getting 2D growth, I feel like.
Yes, I'm like. No, but it's an interesting thought also.
The consumer consumes?
Well, we work in a society where, and in terms of institutional change, it's very important. We work in a society where growth is in the core of everything. Mm. It's how we measure everything. Actually, even ECG performances have this notion of growth in it. So one of the topics we are investigating now, which is also a transition topic, is, okay, but if growth would not be in the core of things, if you wouldn't need the product in the first place, what does it mean for company and what does it mean for society at large?
Mm.
It's a different paradigm. Again, Dineke, it started this podcast by saying the first thing that you have to do is the intention of doing something else.
Yeah.
So the intention of, okay, why don't we build a society where
it's
growth...
It's a paradigm, basically,
paradigm shift.
That we like to consume things, and maybe that's our biggest problem.
So us as consumer on the table, we have a big role to play in it, because yes, we can recycle, yes, we can redesign, yes, we can change the production process, but at the end, we still consume.
I fully agree. And also in my personal life, I try to do degrowth.
Good.
to go for degrowth. And I think my first degrowth academic conference I had last year.
Yeah, last year.
Yeah, organized in, I think, Manchester.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. And that was very interesting that academics are also looking into this. It's a very, very good point. So, yeah, you can reuse all the stuff that you have in your house, multiple times instead of throwing it away and then buying new stuff, which is now the common way of living, actually. Yeah.
And what we must realize here is that we are at Nerode, which is a business school, which is the cathedral of growth education.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And now we introduce a topic which will very shake the fundamentals of what we teach.
Right. You're the mosquitoes.
It's a mosquito, actually, strategy in a way.
But you can also make a business model of collecting stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And redividing it and reselling it.
Yeah. And that's
but then even if you do that as a company, this is the one thing I still don't fully get about degrowth is even if you collect everything and that is becomes your part of your company strategy, you still then make new stuff. Like how does that work?
You will make degrowth is a
only food.
Yeah, well, it's not that
and drinks.
You will not get rid of your well-being. You have to decide, and I think that's the ECG matrix that will tell us this. You have to decide what's well-being means for you. So you will have to decide this and then make choices on what to do and what not to do. In our society today, we are bound in sustainability. It's a big, actually, issue is that people see us as, again, those sustainability guys, they will tell us not to do. Yeah, well, that's part of the story. You have to stop some things and you have to do things differently, like with circular economy.
Yeah, but you have to ask yourself what makes you happy.
Yeah, what makes
is
you happy? Start
stuff?
With this.
Or is it being outside and looking at trees and looking at our beautiful deer in the garden at Nyarode?
So it's a complete redefinition.
That's a good plug.
Yeah, it's a redefinition of the way we live. Okay, we are going very far
and
here.
I think maybe to mention for the listeners is you do also have a full, I think, hour-long exploration on this in your Radical Thinkers, which
yeah,
can be
we
found
organize
on YouTube.
A Radical Thinker conference at Nyarode where the first speaker was Timothée Parik, who is one of the best academics we have right now in the world on degrowth.
And also has a great mustache.
He has a great mustache, yes. nice Frenchie, actually. But what Tineke mentioned also is that it becomes a serious academic topic, which was not the case actually a few years back. So you see also the change of mentality of new academics or new generation also looking at, okay, we have this paradigm, well, can we bring a new one? And how can we explore what would it mean for us in company, in business, in society?
So even in an economy based on degrowth, there's still a lot of stuff. So
exactly.
There could still be a business model for many social enterprises and larger companies and small, medium-sized companies to make a business for themselves because there's so much stuff in our society.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, so we have to do something with that. There's a huge issue with waste. So that's why I said as the fourth pillar of circular economy in your business model is that you have a collection process so that you can pick up your stuff again and reuse it or recycle it. But at this moment, that's not there. So that's why I also concluded that we are not there with circular economy, that every company is not taking responsibility for picking up all the products that they put in the market.
Wow. And would that be something that you can influence or maybe do some research on how, what possibilities
have? What we do is, for instance, in the full-time MBA program, it's an international program at Nyarode, 30 to 40 students every year coming from every part of the world. So we take them on the journey in 24 lectures of 3 hours to find out what is circular economy and sustainable development. We start with talking about their own mindset, how they look at that issue. And then we explain a bit of the theory and then we bring along a lot of smaller and larger companies from different sectors and let them explain how they walk their journey towards circular economy and a circular business model. So we included Fairphone and other social enterprises, but we also included Guard, which is a big insurance company. It insures 50% of the ships worldwide. So it's a Norwegian insurance company, so institutional investor. Other institutional investors, ASN Bank with their biodiversity fund. It's a fund that is there since November also for consumers to invest in. So then you invest in projects that enhance biodiversity rather than make it worse. Yeah, and Niklas comes in to talk about market transformation.
But my wish actually is that at Nairobi and other business schools, actually, the course that Tineke describes now would be the first class that every single student is having. Because
that would be big.
That would be big, but it's actually at the level of the issues we have to solve.
So true.
We can continue the way we do now with business life. We are going directly to a wall. We know that.
You know, what's your strategy to get that much impact?
To be a mosquito, I guess.
Well, at Nairobi, I think we have many mosquitoes at Nairobi on this topic. And I think we are getting to a bigger animal at the moment.
A cloud.
But yeah, we are a cloud of mosquitoes. You know, Tineke, Katrine, Andrea, I could name actually many colleagues that have this dream as well to think of... not reshifting, because I think we are getting into that direction, I think, but having really sustainability in the core of what we teach. Because for us, but for our kids, for our grandkids, that's really what is important right now.
It's very inspiring.
Yeah, and what I also hear from my students is that they wonder why they didn't have that in their university track when they were in their own country. And that is really a reason for them to come to Nairobi to follow this course. And
let's just go for that change then. Yeah. I think that's a very concrete thing.
Yeah, so step that this Nairobi is in one program, take. But we should also introduce it in other programs, of
all
course.
The programs. Yeah.
Okay. Niklas, Tineke, thank you so much for this very inspiring conversation.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Do you guys have anything like a last minute wrap up thought you guys have or wanted to share?
Yeah. There was one topic that we also include in our course, that is stakeholder involvement and stakeholder management. And I wanted to say one thing about that. So before we talked about collaboration with your stakeholders, multi-stakeholder initiatives, but there's always one stakeholder that doesn't have a voice, and that is nature. I mean, there are NGOs that are voicing the interests of nature, but nature itself doesn't have a voice. And that's a really important part of our economy. It's the natural capital that we have. So we should be careful with it, that it will exist also for ourselves later and for the future generations, like Nicholas' sons, kids and grandchildren. So we are also researching at Nairobi the question of, should nature, at least very biodiverse, rich areas, have their own right, a right to prevent pollution, a right to regenerate, a right to be there for itself, for all the birds that live in the trees and all the other animals that live around the trees, that nature is not only a thing at which we look in a functional way, that it is there for us to take the trees and lock the trees or use everything that we see, but that we live in harmony with nature on this planet. So that's another topic that within Nairobi we are now starting a lot of research projects on, to look into nature as...
legislation some, also?
Yes.
Stopping ecocide,
both,
making that...
No, right of nature.
Mm-hmm.
But also, so that's the public law side, so to grant rights to nature areas like the Waddenzee in the Netherlands or the Biesbos or the Veluwe. But also we look at private law initiatives, so initiatives by companies or foundations that are buying a piece of forest or a piece of nature and giving it back to itself.
Well, you have
So we're making a toolkit for... institutions,
because I think it's
so cool.
It's Onslant, which is a big, I think, a creative way that does that.
Yeah,
And I think that's actually a wonderful note, I guess, to end on this conversation.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I hope we'll be hearing more about you guys, especially, you know, you being the first course that every student gets to.
We'll get there.
For sure. Thank you so much for listening. And we'd love for you, if you liked it, to review us with a 5-star rating, please. And of course, don't forget to subscribe to our channel. And if you want to read about the impact cases, you can do so on the Nairobi website. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.